tune out of the anti-white system
and tune into the pro-white system on RadioAryan.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. This is part 32 of our continuing series on Henry Ford's The International Jew. I am Ted Midward, and this is RadioAryan.com. Okay, we start off with a quote at the top of the page here. This is from George Petullo in the Saturday Evening Post. Quote, "Such has been the development of international bankers that they can no longer be regarded in their professional capacity as the nationals of any country, entitled to do business under their own government's supervision exclusively. They are really world citizens, with worldwide interests, and as such, ought to be made amenable to some form of supranational control." End quote. Not only did the Jewish financial firm of Kuhn, Loeb & Company use far-sighted prudence in splitting its political support, one Warburg supporting Wilson, another Warburg supporting Taft, and an unnamed member of the firm supporting Roosevelt, all at one time, as Paul M. Warburg had testified, but it split its activities in several other ways also. The international interests of the Jews comprising this firm are worthy of note. The influence which forced the U.S. to repudiate a commercial treaty with Russia, while Russia was a friendly country in 1911, and thus to compel all business between the United States and Russia to pass through German-Jewish hands, was generated by Jacob H. Schiff. Russia seems to have been the country on which he chose to focus his activities. The full story is told in the Dearborn Independent of January 15, 1921, under the title, "Taft Once Tried to Resist the Jews and Failed," and is reprinted in Volume 2 of the booklet containing this series. Mr. Schiff's activity consisted in forcing the Congress of the United States to do a thing that was repugnant to the reason and conscience of President Taft, and which he personally refused to do or to recommend. Mr. Schiff left the White House in great anger with the threat, "This means war." It did not mean as much war as it might have, for President Taft acquiesced gracefully in the Jewish victory and has since been extremely laudatory of them on the public platform. Mr. Schiff's firm also helped finance the Japanese war against Russia, and in return desired Japan as a Jewish ally. The wily Japs, however, saw the game and kept their relations with Mr. Schiff to purely business matters, which fact is well worth bearing in mind when reading the widespread propaganda for war with Japan. If you will give particular attention, you will observe the same interests which are now, just now, engaged in most loudly defending the Jew are most active in spreading anti-Japanese sentiments in this country. The Japanese war with Russia, however, enabled Mr. Schiff to advance his plan to undermine the Russian Empire, as it has now been accomplished by Jewish Bolshevism. With funds provided by him, the basic principles of what is now known as Bolshevism were sown among the Russian prisoners of war in Japan, who were sent back as apostles of destruction. Then followed the horrible murder of Nicholas Romanov, Tsar of Russia, with his wife, his crippled son, and his young daughters, the full tale of which has now been told by the Jew who managed this crime. For the part he played in destroying Russia, Mr. Schiff was wildly hailed in New York the night the news came that the emperor had abdicated. Meanwhile, the Jew who was to take the Tsar's job, as the common New York ghetto phrase ran weeks before the event, had left New York to be in waiting. This Jew was passed out of the United States at the request of a very high American personage whose subservience to the Jews was one of the marvels of the past 7 years. Halted by the British, this Jew was released from their toils at the request of a very high American personage, and thus the Jewish Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, the program of which was made in America, was set in operation without a hitch. This whole firm is German-Jewish. Its members have originating in Germany. It had German connections. How far it maintained those connections through all subsequent events is a separate question. Mr. Otto Kahn's allotted portion of the world seems to be Great Britain and France. Mr. Kahn is of German origin, like the rest of the firm, but he has not publicly shown such concern for Germany as have the other members. Mr. Schiff was once very active for the settlement of a peace on the basis of a victorious Germany. Mr. Paul M. Warburg also had interests, discussion of which is postponed for the present. But Mr. Kahn succeeded, through the connivance of American authority and the excessive repression of the newspapers, in conveying the impression that by some species of occult separatism, he was not German-minded. Therefore, Mr. Kahn flits lightly everywhere, except Germany. He's sufficiently French to be able to tell in the first column on the first page of Le Matin on what terms America will do business with Europe, and he speaks as one having authority. He is sufficiently British to have thought of standing for the British Parliament when an unfortunate event made it necessary for him to remain in the United States. Mr. Kahn sometimes flits farther east into the more Jewish portions of Europe, and his comings and goings are marked by certain changes with which his name remains most ostentatiously disconnected. Mr. Kahn has very recently been telling France on what terms the U.S. will help her. There apparently being no other spokesman, Mr. Kahn's word is accepted as authority. France is one of the most Judaized countries in the world, the haunt of international Jewish financiers who exercise their power to keep the immigrant Jew out of France, so that France presents the spectacle of being Judaized by Jewish influence and not by immigrant Semitic hordes, and is thus a fit platform from which Mr. Otto Hermann Kahn may utter his pronouncements. In his last declaration to France, Mr. Kahn prepares her to expect little by stating that, quote, America is a country of immense resources, but the actual money which the people have at their disposal is comparatively limited, end quote. True enough, it was a member of Mr. Kahn's firm who invented a monetary system which was promised to keep money in more equal relation to wealth. But as he goes on telling what America will and will not do, the American people knowing nothing about it meanwhile, Mr. Kahn discovers with great enthusiasm a place where he thinks American capital can be placed, namely, quote, in the development of the vast and immensely rich colonial empire of France, end quote. And pray, where is that? Any Frenchman will tell you now, in Syria. Syria, ah, that part of the East where the natives are loudly complaining that the Jews are driving them out contrary to every written and moral law. The Jewish powers have already greatly succeeded in getting French troops over there. Bad blood has been caused between France and Great Britain. The Jews on both sides are playing for the middle. And here is Mr. Otto Kahn himself, pledging American capital to the development of the French colonial empire. Talk to any Syrian who knows his country's present status, and he will interpret Mr. Kahn's words very vividly. One of the nicest bits of work Mr. Kahn has done is to denounce quote-unquote pro-German propaganda, which he says has exasperated Americans in favor of France. Next to committing the United States to an undying admiration for Briand, this is really his finest bit. Especially with partner Paul playing the German sympathy string. It is a great international orchestra, this Jewish financial firm. It can play the Star Spangled Banner, Die Wacht am Rhein, the Marseillaise, and God Save the King in one harmonious rendering, paying obsequious attention to the prejudices of each. Forgive me for the pronunciations there. Next come the Warburgs. Their interest is, of course, in Germany. Paul stated in his testimony given at the beginning of the World War that he had interests in Hamburg and would dispose of them. The war came on. The Jewish government in the United States was augmented. Mr. Warburg was no mean figure, as previous articles have shown. The Warburgs are three in number. Felix M. is the other one in America. He appears but slightly in public affairs, although he is a member of the American Jewish Committee and of the firm Kuhn, Loeb & Company. His retiring habit, however, does not argue lack of consequence. He was of sufficient consequence, Jewishly, to have bestowed upon him a sort of honorary rabbinical degree of Haber, which entitles him to be known as Haber Rabbi Baruch Ben Moshe. He is the only Jew in America upon whom the title has ever been conferred. Max Warburg represents the family in its native land. Max Warburg had as much to do with the German war government as his family and financial colleagues in America had to do with the United States war government. As has been recounted in the press the world over, the brother from America and the brother from Germany both met at Paris as government representatives in determining the peace. And there were so many Jews in the American delegation that the delegates from the minor countries of Europe looked upon the United States as a Jewish country, which, through some unheard method, unprecedented, had a non-Jew as its president. Max Warburg is an interesting character also as regards the establishment of Bolshevism in Russia. The Jews had several objectives in the war, and one of them was to get Russia. To this end, the German Jews worked very assiduously. Because Russia was a member of the Allies, the work of German Jews was made the easier. But the fact that Russia was an ally made no difference with the Jews who were resident in Allied countries. Win or lose, Russia must be destroyed. It is the testimony of history that it was not so much the German military prowess as the Jewish intrigue that accomplished the downfall of that empire. In this work, Max Warburg was a factor. His bank is noted in a dispatch published by the United States government as being one whence funds were forwarded to Trotsky for use in destroying Russia. Always against Russia, not for German reasons, but for Jewish reasons, which in this particular instance coincided. Warburg and Trotsky against Russia. Poor John Spargo, who ought to know better, denies all this. While every American who comes back from Russia, and even those who went over there pro-Bolshevik, yes, and returned Jews themselves, proclaim it. The crushing fact is that Bolshevism is not only Jewish in Russia and in America, but it is Jewish in the higher regions of Jewry, where better things ought to exist. Take Walter Rathenau, a German Jew on the plane of the Warburgs. Rathenau was the inventor of the Bolshevik system of centralization of industry, material, and money. The Soviet government asked Rathenau directly for the plans and received them directly from him. Max Warburg's bank held the money. Walter Rathenau's mind held the plans. Which makes it a pertinent question. If Bolshevism can be so Jewish outside of Russia, what hinders it being Jewish inside of Russia? It's a most significant fact that, as in Washington, the most constant and privileged visitors to the White House were Jews. So in Berlin, the only private telephone wire to the Kaiser was owned by Walter Rathenau. Not even the crown prince could reach the Kaiser except through the ordinary telephone connections. It was the same in London. It was the same in Paris. It was the same in Petrograd. In a Russia which so persecuted the race that controlled it then and controls it now. Now, this sketchy outline of the internationalism of the firm Kuhn, Loeb & Company is not offered as the result of keen research, for the facts are found on the very surface of the matter for anyone to see. What's revealed by this research is this: whether Mr. Schiff's interest in Russia had underground features which affected the welfare of nations, whether Mr. Kahn's flitting missions here and there, which he made with great freedom during the war, were wholly taken up with the business announced in the public notices, and whether Mr. Warburg, whose interest in Germany has not abated, to judge from his recent utterances, was able to retain complete neutrality of mind during the war. These are questions of value. Obviously, they are not easy to answer, but they can be answered. It was a family enterprise, this international campaign. Jacob Schiff swore to destroy Russia. Paul M. Warburg was his brother-in-law. Felix Warburg was his son-in-law. Max Warburg of Hamburg, the banker of the Bolsheviks, was thus the brother-in-law to Jacob Schiff's wife and daughter. Speaking of the far-sighted manner in which the House of Kuhn, Loeb & Company disposes itself over world affairs, there is also the curious fact that in this Jewish firm is one who goes to a Christian church. A most heinous thing for a Jew to do. Split three ways in American politics, and as many ways as international matters require, we find this firm split two ways with regard to religion. Mr. Kahn professes, or at least he attends, a Christian church and is accounted an adherent of it. Yet he is not ostracized. His name is not taboo. The Jews do not curse him. He is not denounced as a renegade. The Jews have not buried him out of mind, as they do with others who desert the faith. This presents a strange situation when it's considered. Not to recount again the horror and reprehension and active antagonism with which Jews view such a desertion, suffice it to say that there is no greater marvel than that of Jacob H. Schiff retaining in the firm Kuhn, Loeb & Company a renegade, quote-unquote renegade, Jew. He could not have done it. Every fiber of his intensely Jewish nature would have rebelled against it. Yet, there it is. Without going further into this ingenious system of covering all vital points from one center, enough has been said to show one busy Jewish financial firm with which political matters, national and international, is almost a profession. The family of Warburg, high in the controlling group of two countries, and enemy countries at that. The family of Warburg, high in the negotiations of world peace and the discussions of a League of Nations. The family of Warburg now advising the world from both sides of the earth what to do next. It was probably with more reason than the general public surmised that a New York paper printed during the peace conference an article headed, "Watch the Warburgs." The fact seems to be that, as Mr. Petullo is quoted as saying at the head of this article, the international financiers have been so engrossed in world money that the sense of national responsibility sometimes becomes blurred in their minds. They desire everything, war, negotiations, and peace, to be conducted in such a way as to react favorably on the money market. For that is their market. Money is what they buy and sell. And because money has no fixed price, it is a market which offers the widest opportunity for the trickster and swindler. One cannot play such tricks with stone or corn or metals, but with money, as the commodity, everything is possible. Mr. Warburg is already very much interested about the treatment to be accorded foreign securities in the next war. Readers of the daily newspapers may recall that recently a demand was made for the gold in the Reichsbank, which was resisted on the ground that the Reichsbank, although the Central Bank of Germany, was really a private concern, just as Paul Warburg said it was, and just as he has insisted that our own Federal Reserve System should be, and which it is. There is far-sighted wisdom in that, with a view to possible defeat in war. Mr. Warburg is apparently quite disapproving of the treatment accorded alien enemy property by some countries. He quotes a French banker throughout, nationality not stated, and drives home his point. The French banker used as an illustration a possible war between England and France. This was only last year, and said that the bankers in each country would proceed to withdraw their mutual balances and securities for fear of confiscation, and that such a course would precipitate a panic. To which Mr. Warburg adds this, quote, I think that our bankers ought carefully study this very serious question. We have nothing to gain and much to lose by joining in a policy of disregarding the rights of private property. We shall probably, in the course of time, become the largest owners of foreign securities and properties, which would become endangered in case we were drawn into war. To me, however, it is of greater interest that nothing be done that might stand in the way of making the United States the gold reserve country of the world. End quote. Such talk passes with too little scrutiny. It bears a strong reflection of recent events, which should not be overlooked. Moreover, it presents a grandiose vision which is supposed to command instant agreement because of its appeal to superficial national pride and selfish ambition. If what Mr. Warburg says is an intimation that the international Jews are planning to move their money market to the U.S., it's safe to say that the United States does not want it. We have the warning of history as to what this would mean. It has meant that, in turn, Spain, Venice, Great Britain, or Germany received the blame and suspicion of the world for what the Jewish financiers have done. It is a most important consideration that most of the national animosities that exist today arose out of resentment against what the Jewish money power did under the camouflage of national names. The British did this, the Germans did that, when it was really the international Jew who did it, the nations being but the marked spaces on his checkerboard. Today, around the world, the blaming word is heard. The United States did this. If it were not for the United States, the world would be in better shape. The Americans are a sordid, greedy, cruel people. Why? Because the Jewish money power is largely centered here and is making money out of both our immunity and Europe's distress, playing one against the other. And because so many of the so-called American businessmen abroad today are not Americans at all, they're Jews, and in many cases, they are misrepresentative of their own race as they are of the Americans. The United States does not want the transfer of all Juden to this soil. We do not desire to stand as a gold god above the nations. We should serve the nations, and we would protect them, but we would do so in the basis of real values, not in the name or under the sign of gold. On the one hand, Mr. Warburg recites pitiful facts about Germany in order to raise sympathy for her, and on the other hand, he stimulates the gold lust of the United States. The plight of Germany is entirely due to the forces from which the U.S. has only narrowly escaped, and to hearken to international Jewish plans for rehabilitation of Germany is to be in danger of approving plans which will fasten Jewish domination more strongly on that unhappy country than it is now. Germany has paid dearly for her Jews. The Warburg voice that speaks for her would seem indeed to be the voice of Jacob, but the hand that proposes financial dealings is that of Esau, no doubt. The internationalism of the Warburgs is no longer in doubt and cannot be denied. Felix Warburg hung on to the Hamburg connection longer than did Paul. But the breakage of either was probably perfunctory. At the same time that Felix left the Hamburg firm of his brother, Max, a Mr. Stern also left the Frankfurt firm of Stern and became very active on the Allies' side, taking sides against the German nation as lustily as one could. Impossible, say those who fancy that a German Jew is a German. Not impossible at all. The Jew's loyalty is to the Jewish nation, and what the Jew himself refers to as his cover nationality may count or not as he himself elects. This statement is always met with frothing wrath by the Jews' Gentile fronts in the purchased pro-Jewish press. But here's another example. Do you remember the Beast of Berlin, that lurid piece of war propaganda? You did not, perhaps, know that its producer was a German Jew, Karl Lamley. His German birth did not prevent him making money out of his film, and his film does not prevent him annually going back in state to his birthplace. This year, he goes accompanied by Abe Stern, his treasurer, Lee Kolmar, his director, and Harry Reichenbach, a list of names duplicable in any movie group. Stern and Warburg, of Frankfurt and Hamburg respectively, and always from home, perhaps only temporarily, were not concerned about the fate of the Huns, but they were immensely concerned about the fate of Jewish money power in Germany. To indicate how blind the public has been to the inter-allied Jewish character of much of the world's important international financial activity, note from this Living Age publication earlier this year, quote, according to the Svens Handelsstinning, the recent American loan of $5 million to Norway was really the outcome of an agreement between the Hamburg firm of Warburg & Company and the New York bankers Kuhn and Loeb. It is regarded as a significant sign of the times that a German firm should be responsible for an American loan to a neutral country. The conditions subject to which this money was borrowed are not regarded as very favorable to Norway, and no market effect on the rate of exchange between the two countries has followed. End quote. Note, in the light of all the statements made about Kuhn, Loeb & Company, and the Warburgs in particular, the assumption in the above quotation that the transaction was really between a German and an American firm. It was principally an arrangement between the Warburgs themselves in the family council. But the loan will pass in Norway as an American loan, and the fact that the terms of the loan are not regarded as very favorable to Norway will react upon Scandinavian opinion of this country. It goes without saying that no market effect on the rate of exchange between the two countries has followed, for that would not be the object of such a loan. The dislocation of exchange is not unprofitable. It would be most interesting to know in how far Kuhn, Loeb & Company has endeavored to readjust the rate of exchange. During the war, Kuhn, Loeb & Company made a loan to the city of Paris. Considerable German comment was occasioned by this, naturally, and it is very well worthy of record that in the city of Hamburg, where Max Warburg does business, the chief of police issued this order, quote, further mention in the press of loans made by the firm of Kuhn, Loeb & Company to the city of Paris, and unfavorable comments thereon are forbidden, end quote. The following story is vouched for as reliable, and if one or two minor details it does not represent the exact fact, it is a trustworthy illustration of how certain things were done. Here is that story. A Jewish international banking corporation bought up the mining and other similar concessions of Yugoslavia, and consequently the policy pushed at the peace conference was that which was most convenient for that group. An understanding on the Fiume question was in progress between Wilson and Nitti. Certain concessions had been agreed upon, and Wilson was willing to negotiate, when Oscar Strauss and one of the Warburgs appeared on the scene. Wilson changed his attitude overnight and afterward insisted on the Yugoslavia solution of the problem. The way in which concessions had been bought through that territory was a disgrace, and observers expected that it would play an important part at the peace conference. The financiers are not the only international Jews in the world. The revolutionary Jews, of all countries and none, are also international. They have seized upon the idea of Christian internationalism, which means amity between nations, and they've used it as a weapon with which to weaken nationality. They know as well as anyone that there can be no internationalism except on the basis of strong nationalism, but they count on cover words to advance their plan. Enough transpired between the lower and higher Jewish groups of every large center during the war to render it imperative that Jewry confess, repent, and repudiate the madness that has ruled it, or else boldly assert and espouse it before the world. Certainly enough has transpired to render it desirable that the American people look again into the purposes of those Jews who were instrumental in reorganizing our financial system at a most critical time in the world's history. Max Warburg was apparently strong enough to suppress German discussion of his brother's activity in America. The Warburgs at present reside in America and must suffer it. Therefore, that American comment be made as full as need be. That is the end of the first half of today's episode. This was published in the Dearborn Independent on July 9th, 1921. Well, not a whole lot to comment on here. It's kind of dealing with the same issues that we've already seen in previous articles. The Jews control the money and loaning of money in the international money system. That is the root of all their power. And in a way, it's their main strength, but it's also their greatest Achilles heel. Let it be known that for anyone in the future who's trying to figure out some political solution for their little independent nation and they want to do this and that, let me warn you, please take heed to this. If you do not strip and neuter the Jews of their money power, all is for naught. You are pissing in the wind, wasting your time. Dracula must be defanged, and the only way to do it is to take away the money power. Moving on to the next article. This is entitled Jewish Power in America's Money Famine. The international Jewish banker, who has no country but plays them all against one another, and the international Jewish proletariat that roams from land to land in search of a peculiar type of economic opportunity, are not figments of the imagination, except to the non-Jew who prefers a lazy laxity of mind. Of these classes of Jews, one or both are at the heart of the problems that disturb the world today. The immigration problem is Jewish. The money question is Jewish. The tie-up of world politics is Jewish. The terms of the peace treaty are Jewish. The diplomacy of the world is Jewish. The moral question in movies and theaters is Jewish. The mystery of the illicit liquor business is Jewish. These facts are unfortunate as well as unpleasant for the Jew, and it is squarely up to him to deal with the facts and not waste time in trying to destroy those who define the facts. These facts are interpreted by the Jew and the anti-Semite with strange extremes of blindness. The Jew never gets the world's point of view at all. He always gets the anti-Semite's point of view, and the anti-Semite is equally at fault in always getting the Jew's point of view. What both of them need is to get society's point of view, which is the one thing being set forth in this present series of articles. To say that the immigration problem is Jewish does not mean that Jews must be prohibited entry to any country. It means that they must become rooted to a country in loyal citizenship, as no doubt some are, and as no doubt most are not. To say that the money question is Jewish does not mean that Jews must get out of finance. It means that they must rid finance of the Jewish idea, which has always been used to get money, to get a stranglehold on men and business concerns, instead of using finance to help general business. To say that the tie-up of world politics is Jewish does not mean that Jews, as human beings, are to be denied a voice in affairs. It means that they must give up trying to make the world revolve around the Jewish nation as its axis. To describe the influence of the Jew on the theater is not to demand that he leave the theater, but it is to demand that he rid the theater of his idea that sensualism is entertaining. The Jewish question is first for the Jews to solve. If not, the world will have to solve it for them. They may stay in business, say the theater, for example, if they will cease spoiling the theater. If they do not cease, the theater will be taken away from them just as certainly as day follows night. The world has been patient, and the world will be fair, but the world knows the limit of imposition. It's not the true Jewishness of the Jew, nor yet the nationalism of the Jew that's on trial, but his anti-national internationalism. A true Mosaic Jew, not a Talmud Jew, would be a good citizen. A nationalist Jew would at least be logical. But an international Jew has proved an abomination, because his internationalism is focused on his own racial nationalism, which, in turn, is founded on his ingrained belief that the rest of humanity is inferior to him and, by right, his prey. Jewish leaders may indulge in all the platitudes they possess. The fact which they cannot deny is that the Jew has, for centuries, regarded the goyim as beneath him and legitimately his spoil. The internationalism of the Jew is confessed everywhere by him. Listen to a German banker. Imagine the slow, oily voice in which he said this. Quote, "We are international bankers. Germany lost the war. What of it? That is an affair of the army. We are international bankers." End quote. It was like a pro boxing fight bout in New Jersey or a baseball game in Chicago. An affair of the fighters. We are international bankers. So what? A nation is being hamstrung by artificial exchange rates, another by the sucking of money out of its channels of trade. What about it to the international banker? He has his own game to play. Hard times bring more plums tumbling off the tree into the baskets of the international bankers than does any other kind of times. Wars and panics are the Jewish international bankers' harvests. That's a big quote. Did you hear that? That's a notable quote from Henry Ford. Let me say it again. Wars and panics are the Jewish international bankers' harvests. Citizens wake up with a start to find that even the white nations are hardly allowed to see each other nowadays, except through Jewish eyes. When the United States supposedly speaks to France, through whom does she speak? All that France sees is Otto H. Kahn. Why must a Jew represent the United States of America to France? When France supposedly speaks to the United States, through whom is it done? Through Viviani, Jewish in every thought and method. Now they are talking of sending Millerand over, another Jew. Britain sends Lord Reading. Germany sent Dr. Dernburg. Into other countries, the United States sent Morgenthau, Strauss, Warburg, and lesser Jewlings. It comes with something of a shock to learn that folk is coming to the United States. We have not seen a Frenchman since Joffre visited us. It is good to see man of the white race come across the sea as if to reassure us that white men still live in those countries. The business of the peace conference was done by Jews. Has it come to a point where international diplomacy is to become a Jewish monopoly also? Must these special conversations between France, Britain, and the United States be held through Jewish interpreters while Anglo-Saxons and true Frenchmen do the routine embassy work? Or shall it be possible for the non-Jewish nations to see one another occasionally through non-Jewish representatives? Internationalism is not a Jewish conviction, but a Jewish business device. It is most profitable. In diplomacy and at the immigrant station, internationalism pays. Jews interpret nation to nation in the high rights of special conversations between governments. Jewish interpreters swarm at the ports of every country also, where the poor swarm in. It was stated in the House of Lords the other day that most of the trouble in Palestine was caused by Jewish interpreters. It was charged that the Jewish administration added an extra language to the official list in order to make Jewish interpreters indispensable. Go through the government of the United States, where the income tax secrets are kept, where the Federal Reserve secrets are kept, where the State Department secrets are kept, and you'll find Jews sitting at the very spot where international Jewry desires them to sit, and where nothing is kept from their knowledge. Go abroad and come back to your country, and a Jew will open the gate to let you in, or close it to keep you out, as he chooses. Will you be going to Detroit while you're here? Asks a Jewish government agent of a gentleman entering the country on a visit a few weeks ago. I may go to Detroit, was the reply. Well, you go to the damn Dearborn Independent and tell them a Jew let you into this country, said the government agent. What the visitor replied is known, but had better not be quoted. The American Jewish Committee might shriek that the people were being incited to pogroms. The incident, however, is but a sample of what is occurring every day. The truth about the Jewish question in the U.S. is perhaps the one form of truth that cannot be indiscriminately told. The international Jewish bankers regard themselves as, in similar fashion, letting the nations do this or that, regarding the nations not as fatherlands but as customers, and as customers in the Jewish sense. If an army wins or loses, if a government succeeds or fails, so what? That's their business. That's their problem. We are international bankers, and we win whoever loses. For international Jewish bankers, the war is not over. The period of actual hostilities and the emergencies of the nations were but the opening of the trade. The ready cash was skimmed in then, all the cash the world had. True, some of it had to be distributed among the people as war wages and bonuses in order to keep the struggle going, but this was soon recovered through the means of high prices, artificial scarcities, and the orgy of extravagance deliberately organized and stimulated among the people. That phase, over, and money disappeared. Is there any more tragic joke than that diligently disseminated in this country? The United States has more gold than any other country in the world. Well, where is it? How long since you've seen a piece of gold? Where is all this gold? Is it locked up in the treasury of the United States government? Why, that government is in debt, desperately trying to economize, cannot pay a soldier bonus because the finances of the country cannot stand it. Where is that gold? It may be in the United States, but it does not belong to the United States. The American farmer and those American industries which were not wise to the tricks of international Jewish bankers and who were nipped by small loans are wondering where all this money is. Furthermore, Europe, suffering from every possible lack, is looking to us and wondering where the money is. This dispatch from a London paper may throw light on the matter. Quote, it is learned today that the new gold shipments are aggregating $2.8 million are consigned to Kuhn, Loeb & Company of New York, making nearly $129 million imported by that firm since the movement started. In responsible banking circles, the belief is expressed that some of the German coin recently imported by the firm is from Russia instead of Germany, as generally supposed. End quote. This dispatch, coupled with one printed in a former article which showed Warburg & Company of Germany arranging with Kuhn Loeb & Company of New York for a $5 million loan to Norway, is not devoid of light on the question, where is the money? The Jewish international banking system may be easily described. First, there is the International Jewish Headquarters. This was in Germany. It had ramifications in Russia, Italy, France, Great Britain, and the South American states. Germany and Russia were the two countries scheduled for punishment by the international Jewish bankers because these two countries were most aware of the Jew. They have been punished. That job is done. Jewish political headquarters, as related to the internal affairs of the Jews, was also located in Germany, but the headquarters dealing with the Goyim was in France. Statements have been made that the political center of Jewry has been transplanted to the U.S., but these statements have been made by American Jews, whose wish may have been father to the thought. During the Wilson administration, it was possible for a Jew to think and to hope this, but affairs have slightly changed. The ousting of American Jews from the Zionist movement at behest of Eastern Jews indicates that if the political center of world Jewry has shifted to the U.S., the power is still in the hands of aliens resident here. This center is still in Jewry. The United States is merely a square on Jewry's world checkerboard. But wherever the financial and political world centers may be, each country is separately handled. In every country, the United States, Mexico, and the republics of South America, in France, England, Italy, Germany, Austria, yes, and in Japan, there is an international Jewish banking firm which stands at the head of the group for that country. Thus, the chief Jewish firm in the U.S. is Kuhn Loeb & Company, of which one of the members is Paul M. Warburg, brother of Max Warburg & Company, and of Hamburg. And another member of which is Otto H. Kahn, resident successively of Germany, Great Britain, and the U.S., and self-appointed financial spokesman for the U.S. to France and Great Britain. Great Britain and France seldom see a special American spokesman who is not a Jew. That may be the reason why they reciprocate by sending Jews to us, thinking perhaps that we prefer them. Paul M. Warburg was the inventor, perfecter, and director of the Federal Reserve System of the United States. He's not the only Jew in the Federal Reserve System, but he was the chief Jew there. His mind counted for a great deal. There were others in the war government, of course, Bernard M. Baruch, Eugene Meyer Jr., Hoover's Regiment of Jews, Felix Frankfurter, Julius Rosenwald, hundreds of them, and everywhere. But the financial group alone is receiving our attention just now, and they are not so notably successful in getting the country out of financial difficulty as they were in other lines of effort. The Federal Reserve System may not be a bad system, in spite of the fact that it yields government monetary functions to private financial corporations, but there are all sorts of testimony that it has been badly manipulated. Mr. Warburg, the reader will remember, spoke about certain things being overcome in an administrative way, showing that there was a certain amount of play or loose motion in the system which could be manipulated either way. The fact remains that the country went swimmingly through the war by reason of the assistance of the system, and is coming very lamely through the peace as the result, monetary experts say, of the hindrance of the same system. Mr. Warburg, whose name was so prominently connected with the advertisement of the glory of the system, must also stand being mentioned in connection with the criticism. Whatever money we are said to have as the per capita in the U.S., it's a false statement. The money per capita should always be figured on the basis of money in circulation. The statistical per capita is not always in circulation. Less than half of it, as a rule. The rest is being juggled. Whatever the gold in the country, the wealth is still greater. There is more wealth in the United States than there is gold in the world. 1 year's products of the farms of the United States exceeds in money value all the gold in the world. Yet, under our present system, the burgeoning bulk of the country's wealth must pass through the narrow neck of money, and the money must pass through the still narrower neck of gold. And the controller of the gold, under our present system, controls the world. There is more wealth than there is money. There is more money than there is gold. Money exists at the pleasure of gold. Wealth moves at the pleasure of money. Whoever sits at the neck of money, opening or closing as he will, controls the movement of the world's wealth. And the world's prosperity depends on the movement of that wealth. When wealth stands still and does not pass from hand to hand, the world's circulation has stopped. The world becomes economically sick. The scarcity of cash in hand has led to credit. Credit is another form of barter. It's a form of dealing by which many transactions are carried on, only the final one being cleared in money. It's a device which has its dangers, in spite of the efforts of apologists to exploit its advantages. But one thing the system of credit indubitably does, it allows the money masters to hang on to the cash. When the world is caught with paper, not with cash. The cash is always in the hands of those who extol the advantage of the credit system. Who holds money holds power, and will hold it until real barter or real money comes in fashion again. Boy, there's a lot there we could go off into tangents on, but I'm going to keep reading. In 1919 to 1920, according to one of the best monetary authorities in the United States, the total shrinkage in values of the products of our fields, mines, factories, mills, and forests represented a sum greater than the total gold supply of the world. It runs as high as the total amount of Liberty bonds outstanding. People say, well, the prices were too high. Certainly they were too high, but who and what made them too high? It was the generosity with which money was supplied by the Federal Reserve System. There was plenty of money. People say, well, the shrinkage is only in paper values. The real value of the product is still there. Certainly, but when you live under a system in which real value and money value are so intimately intertwined that it affects your bread and butter, the tenure of your farm, and the steadiness of your job, it's pretty hard to separate the two. Moreover, when your prosperity was due to the readiness of a group of men to let out money, and your adversity is due to the unwillingness of the same group, and your own welfare and your country's welfare is thus seesawed up and down, without any reference to natural law but solely upon determinations taken in committee rooms, you would naturally inquire, who's doing this? Where is all the money gone? Who's holding it? Here is the wealth of the country. Here is the need of the country. Where is the money to transfer the wealth to the need? Every condition remains as it was except money. We have a Federal Reserve System which still is benefiting by the assistance of its perfecter and director, Paul M. Warburg. And what is the condition in the United States? Some of the biggest industrial institutions in the country now in the hands of creditors' committees. Farmers being sold out by the hundreds, their horses bringing about $3 each. Cotton and wool enough to clothe the nation, spoiling in the hands of the men who raised it and cannot dispose of it. Every line of business, railroading, newspaper publishing, storekeeping, manufacturing, agriculture, building, is in depression. Why? For lack of money. Where is the money? This is a country that is supposed to be the financial center of the world. Where is the money? It's in New York. The Federal Reserve System, which Mr. Warburg designed to head up in one central bank, has just about turned out that way. The money is in New York. Here is the charge made to the governor of the Federal Reserve Board by a responsible public official who knows that while there is a scarcity of money for the producing sections of the West and the Northwest, the South and the Southwest, we find that individual banks in New York City are borrowing from the Federal Reserve System, in a number of cases, more than $100 million each, and sometimes as much as $145 million is loaned there to a single bank, twice as much as some of the reserve banks have been lending recently to all the member banks in their districts. One bank in New York borrowed $134 million, or $20 million more than the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City was advancing to 1,091 member banks in that reserve district, which covers the states of Kansas, Nebraska, Colorado, Wyoming, and parts of Missouri, Oklahoma, and New Mexico. At the same time, another New York bank was borrowing from the Federal Reserve about $40 million, which was more than the aggregate loans which the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis was lending to its 1,000 member banks in the great states of Minnesota, North and South Dakota, Montana, and part of Wisconsin. Another New York bank borrowed from the Federal Reserve Bank a sum which was greater by $30 million than the Federal Reserve Bank at Dallas was lending to all the banks in Texas, Louisiana, and Oklahoma. Still, another New York bank got a loan which equaled the total loans allowed by the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis to the 569 member banks of that very important district, which includes the whole state of Arkansas, part of Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Mississippi, and the larger part of Missouri. Take the 5th Federal Reserve District, served by the Federal Reserve Bank at Richmond, Virginia. One New York bank was able to borrow from the New York Reserve Bank more than the Richmond Reserve Bank would lend to all its member banks in Maryland, Virginia, North and South Carolina, and the larger part of West Virginia. That is the situation. The 12 regional banks, which were supposed to make money serve all parts of the country equally, have apparently been overcome in an administrative way to such an extent that the New York Federal Reserve Bank is to all intents and purposes the central bank of the United States and serves the speculative part of the country with millions, while the productive part of the country is permitted to wilt with paltry thousands. When it can occur that 4 New York banks can borrow from the New York Federal Reserve Bank as much money as the banks of 21 states were able to borrow from the 5 Federal Reserve Banks of St. Louis, Kansas City, Minneapolis, Dallas, and Richmond, there would seem to be need of explanation somewhere. Where did this money loaned in New York come from? It came from those parts of the country where the money was scarcest. In May 1920, the word went out over the telephone, "The tie-up will come on the 15th. And it came. Credit was stopped. Payment was pressed. A stream of money, literally squeezed out of the producing sections of the country, began to roll toward New York. Otherwise, those giant loans just recorded would have been impossible. It was pressure, Federal Reserve pressure, politely known as deflation, and that is the way it worked. The banks of the West were squeezed dry that the banks of New York might overflow. The money was withdrawn from legitimate business in various parts of the country to be loaned at fancy rates in Wall Street, says the official referred to above. The speculative banks, as it has been discovered, were able to borrow money at 16%, which money they loaned at as high as 20, 25, and 30%. Federal Reserve deflation created a scarcity which speculative banks utilized. The Federal Reserve policy took the money out. New York banks borrowed the money taken out and loaned it at tremendous rates, rates which people paid to stave off the ruin caused by the moneyless condition which the ill-measured deflation process brought on. And all this time, the Federal Reserve System was in the best financial condition of its whole career. In December 1920, it had 45% of its reserves, which was a higher reserve than it had in December 1919. But at this writing, which is July 1921, the reserve has reached 60%. The money is in New York. Go out through the agricultural states and you won't find it there. Go into the districts of silent factories and you will not find it there. The money is in New York. The Warburg Federal Reserve has deflated the country. A system that was intended to equalize the ups and downs of financial weather has been used in an administrative way to deplete the country of money. The Federal Reserve idea was doubtless right. If it had not been, it could not have been established. But it's been manipulated. It has not been a Federal Reserve. It's been a private reserve. It has been operated in the interest of bankers and not of everyone in general. Capable of being used to carry the country gradually back to a natural flow of business and to a natural level of prices, it was used to bludgeon business at a critical time and to bludgeon it in such a way that moneylenders profited when the producers suffered. If that is the fact, there's no American banker but will say that the method was wrong. Economically wrong, logically wrong, commercially wrong, if not entirely criminally wrong. Today, the Federal Reserve boasts of its own reserve as if that were a sign of national economic health. While the country is struggling to live, the Federal Reserve ought to be low, not high. The height which the reserve has reached is a measure of the depth of the country's depression. If the Federal Reserve would let out a part of that flood of money, a high financial authority suggests that less than 10% would do it, it would be like an infusion of blood into the nation's veins. Kuhn, Loeb & Company, the Spires, and the other Jewish moneylenders have money from Mexico, Norway, Germany, and all sorts of commercial companies being organized to do business overseas, and it is American money. The Warburg Federal Reserve system has been badly misused, badly manipulated, and the country is suffering from it. Still, the people know not what to do. Money is still a mystery. Banking is still sacrosanct. What would be perfectly apparent if done in ordinary business intercourse with a $5 bill is exceedingly complicated when the sum is $5 million and the parties are 1. Country banks, 2. Federal Reserve banks, and 3. Wall Street speculative institutions. Yet they are only Tom, Dick, and Harry with the $5 bill, after all. The matter is somewhat affected by the gags that are placed on many men competent to criticize. High officials are more or less tied up by campaign contributions in which all financial concerns have an interest. Legislative officials are, to many of them, indebted to these same interests. A schedule of the private debts of some of the men who have aspired to the presidency in the last 8 years would be very illuminating, almost as illuminating as a schedule of the names of Jews at whose homes they have stayed while on journeys throughout the country. Men who are thus tied up with the present financial system cannot say what in their minds they know. It is all illustrated in the testimony of T. Cushing Daniel before a committee of Congress. It shows to what an extent the power of this private corporation called the central bank can reach. Here's the quote. When going through the Bank of England, I presented a letter, which I had from Secretary Hay, and the official of the bank was very polite. He took me through the bank, and when we got back to the reception room, I asked him if he would allow me to put up a few leading questions to him. He said he would, and I asked him if he would give me a statement of the Bank of England. We do not issue statements. Does not the House of Parliament sometimes call on you for some statement as to the condition of the bank? No, sir, they do not call on us. How is it that some of these revolutionists, so-called, do not get up in the House of Commons and raise the devil to know something about what is going on down here? That would be the condition in our country. Oh, well, most of them are large borrowers from the bank, and we have no difficulty with them. Oh. End quote, end excerpt, end story. Okay, that is the end of the second article. This was published, of course, in the Dearborn Independent. The date was July 16th, 1921. you know, the financial issue, they make it really complicated. There's a veil of complexity. And once you get past that veil of complexity and see it for what it is, it's really simple at the root. If you understand that whoever controls the money and the loaning of it to the economy, to the country, basically controls whether or not there's a boom or a bust, and they can choose who gets the money. And when you have speculators and international Jews controlling the money spigot of the country, guess what? Wall Street, speculation, the investment world, the paper pushers, the money loaners, money lenders, loan sharks, these people are all going to get the interest. They're all going to get top flight. They're all going to get pole position to get that money. The real producers of the country, the people who manufacture goods, the farmers who produce the food supply, the agricultural sector, these people are on the bottom of the totem pole. That's exactly what has happened. And what it is a giant transfer of wealth from the people who work, the bee colony, so to speak, the goyim who do all the work. And then we hand it all over to the Jews via interest. And the fact that we do all the work and they issue the loans and sit back and do nothing. They produce nothing, yet they leech and suck dry everything. They live lavishly on the fat of the land, which is taken from the working class and given to the Wall Street crowd. There's another quote, and I think it was from the International Jews, from Henry Ford, or it's attributed to Henry Ford. I don't know if we covered it. I don't think we have. I've been waiting to see it pop up in one of these articles, but the saying or the quote goes something to the effect of, it's all well and good that the people of this country do not understand the monetary and banking system, because if they did, there'd be a revolution with pitchforks tomorrow. I thought we were going to hit that quote in this article. Instead, we hit panics and wars or the Jews' harvest. That's a big one to remember. Guys, this was 100 years ago. 100 years ago, America was in this state. In one sense, it's amazing. 2 World Wars later and all these other, it's amazing we even have a country, so to speak. Of course, we really don't, but oh, it's amazing we have anything with having these vipers and these parasites just suck us dry. There's an old political cartoon that really sums it up. I'm sure most of you guys have seen it. It's an old black and white cartoon, and it has two men sitting at a table, a dinner table, eating dinner. And the skinny, lanky man who's famished is twirling his fork and feeding it to a fat, greedy pig sitting there. And he's, of course, the fat, greedy pig is symbolized as the money banking system and Wall Street. And the skinny, famished, starving man is the working class, the producers, the workers, the people who make the country actually move. That picture says it all. And it's been one of my favorite political cartoons. Well, I want to reiterate for anyone in a position in the future and somehow listening to this, just remember, if you do not neuter the Jews, if you do not separate them from the money power, the power to create money out of nothing and to loan it with interest to a king or a nation state or a government, you are never going to stop the Jews. They have to be stripped of their economic financial power. And you can put them on Alcatraz, you can put them in Madagascar, but if they're allowed to control the money and loan money to governments and to the goyim, things will never change. You will continue to be low, and they will be continually made to be very high. That's the way it works. Until next time, this is Ted Midward signing off. You are listening to RadioArian.com. God bless you. Praise Christ. Praise Yahweh. Bye-bye.
Tuned in to Radio Arian.